Did we make it to a good afternoon? Thank you for staying. Thank you for coming. And my name is Clarice Rozaa Sharif, and I would like to welcome you on behalf of Mr. Howard Dodson, our director, to the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. I want to welcome you to this wonderful event, After the Dance, Conversations on Michael Jackson's Black America. Last night, Nelson George and Touré started the conversation in a very beautiful way. And today, we have a fantastic lineup, and hopefully you'll enjoy it all. Now, I want to introduce you to Linné Denise, the person who actually brought the idea for this whole event to us here at the Schomburg Center. I want to thank her so much for the great idea and the great work and efforts that it took to make it happen. Ashley Bowden, our Schomburg intern, also helped us dot the I's and cross the T's. So now, please welcome Linné Denise.
Hello, everyone, and actually welcome back to those of you who were here last night. Who was here last night, by a show of hands? Wow, loyal. Thank you, and welcome back. I was actually just sitting here thinking about a message that I received. There was a woman who talked about, and she's actually in the audience now. You can raise your hand if you feel comfortable doing so, but she said that, you know, it was just three people in the world, her, God, and Michael Jackson. And I... Donna, I don't want to call you out, but I thought that was an incredible thing to say, and I know that a number of people feel that way. And so with that, welcome to After the Dance. Again, my name is Linné Denise, and I would also like to thank Clarice, because without a second between her answer and the presentation, she said yes to the idea of hosting this event. And like I said last night, it is an honor, first of all, to have a space to, you know, talk about Michael Jackson as a special creature that he is, but to do it in one of the most important cultural institutions in the world. So thank you, Clarice and the Schomburg. But also, this was a real grassroots effort, I want to say. Thank you to each and every single one of the panelists. Something that is super important to me is that it was a grassroots effort. Not a single panelist asked for a dime. There were people who traveled here from other states, someone from Duke University, Mark Anthony Neal, and it's just, again, a testament of who Michael Jackson is and was in our lives, and so please, a round of applause for the panelists here. I would like to emphasize again that this is a safe space for a conversation about the magic that Michael leaves us with, but also a conversation that will respectfully honor the difficulties and questions that his public personal life brings up for us. And so yesterday there were a few lively comments about everything from Joe Jackson and the possibility of Michael Jackson being gay or straight, and obviously those are issues that reflect the heightened emotions around his life, and again, this is why we have this forum here today. I know that we want to create a space where it is a dialogue for you to contribute to the conversation as well, and so we'll have questions at the end of each panel. But before we get started, I actually believe strongly in letting Michael set the tone for the day. And this is a clip that I found. I mean, after he died, I actually spent like the last year reading LaToya Jackson's book, reading Michael Jackson's book, reading Margo Jefferson's book on Michael, just studying YouTube, spending time on Wikipedia, just trying to learn as much as I could about him because he moved me so much. And the intimidating thing was to learn how much I didn't know about him and to learn about how he had a full life in like, what, 5 decades? And so I had a lot to reflect on, to think about, and to learn from. And it's really intimidating, but this was a clip that I found to be incredible. And this is Michael Jackson and James Brown at the Beverly Theater in Los Angeles. And one thing that I want you to look for is his timing, the moment that he grabs the mic and the timing, because I was absolutely amazed by it. So without further ado.
We're going to get it hot before we call them. And without rapping, he said, don't do it, but I got to do it. I got to say it anyway. We got another fantastic people for you. It's too much to be a person, it's just a people. Because he's so beautiful, and I love him for so many years. The surprise is here. A young man I watched grow and grow. Like I said, the audience was so beautiful, you have to jump back sometime and kiss yourself and count the blessings and thank God each and every day. It just keep happening. I got a new inspiration, a new motivation, because I just certain things happen to you, make you feel good. If you will, ladies and gentlemen, very quiet and very humble and very meek and just beautiful and full of talent and just running out of ears, he and his whole family. If you will, let's give another standing ovation for a young man sitting behind you that you have no idea who's in the audience. Michael Jackson, roll Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson. You gotta come up and say something. You gotta come up and say something. Michael Jackson, come on up, Mike. Come up and say something. You gotta come up and say something.
Was that at least worth the technical difficulties? Okay, because that's, you know, we're humans up here, and I was like, for Michael, please play this video, but you can't get... But actually, do you see what I mean about the timing and the fact that he was greeting the crowd, shaking hands, hugged James Brown, and within seconds, I love you, right? And so I'm like, when did he have the time to hear where the one was? And so he was just, you know, aligned with, you know, music. And so... Yeah, I just wanted him to, and just also the James Brown piece and just the full circle, because in 1968, maybe 69, we know the Motown video that's famous where he is meeting Berry Gordy for the first time, and not even imitating, but I would say he internalized James Brown's movement to the point where it became a part of his DNA, right? And he also spoke at James Brown's funeral, and so it was just a full circle, as well as Jackie Wilson. I know that Nelson George made a point yesterday that Jackie Wilson had a huge impact on Michael Jackson as well. So I just wanted to kind of make it clear that Michael comes from a lineage of people, that he was on a Chitlin' circuit with some of my grandparents, great-grandparents, in Black Gary, Indiana, in Black St. Louis, in Black Chicago, and then later in Black L.A., but that he actually is a universal creature, and so he was also influenced by Fred Astaire, by Shirley Temple, by Charlie Chaplin. And so, you know, he just forces us to ask some of those questions about race and identity. And so I would like to talk about the first panel and introduce it. To Be White, Gifted, and Black will be moderated by Esther Amar. And I thought she made the most sense as the moderator because she epitomizes the African diaspora's relationship with Michael Jackson and his music. She is Ghanaian. She lived in London. She traveled all over the African continent. She's been published all over. What you were published in Africa as well as London, as well as America. You guys may know her from the WBAI Wake Up Call show. Esther Amar is an incredible woman, and little does she know, a mentor for me. And so she was actually one of the first people that came up for me when I thought about this conference. So without further ado, Esther Amar.
Okay, good afternoon. So, we want to be starting something, right? Thank you for coming. Michael Jackson, the dude of badness himself, king of pop, the gloved one. This afternoon, what we want to do is have a kind of a collabo convo, a lyrical exchange. There's a whole range of writers and artists who wrote brilliantly after Michael died. I think probably the one exception that everybody spoke about with such affection and thought was the piece that Greg Tate wrote in The Village Voice. But there were so many other folks, whether they were writers who were published, whether it was us who were on Facebook, whether we were tweeting in conversation, whether we replayed Michael. We had music and musings and memories and analysis and discussion. So we want to bring a range of what Mr. Arthur Jaffa called creative imaginings to this conversation. We know that Michael Jackson is not a linear person. Probably the only thing we all agree on is that he was a genius. The rest is all up for conversation and discussion. So, on that note, I'm going to call up my panelists and introduce them as I call them up. We have Mr. Arthur Jaffa, who is a cultural critic and worker, a visual artist, and an African diasporic organic intellectual of the first order. His infrequently published thinking, ain't that an introduction?
Oh, sorry.
Around questions of black cultural politics, black cultural nationalism, and film is simply visionary. As a cinematographer, he has done work with Julie Dash on Daughters of the Dust, as well as Spike Lee's Crooklyn and Mansia Diawara's Rauch in Reverse. One of Jaffa's projects is the development of what he calls black visual intonation. Jaffa is interested in the ways in which a black film culture can be developed that responds and reflects black ways of life in the diaspora and investigating what he calls black artificial intelligence. Come sit down, Mr. AJ. I'm going to introduce cool DJ Marv next. Marvin Coleman, not just a DJ that rocks your body, but one who cannot forget about your mind. Through the mixing of music, Marv is able to transform any venue into an atmosphere of celebratory togetherness. Applying the magic of the segue to multiple genres of music is the way that Marv brings together worlds. Philadelphia native and current Harlem resident, Marv is well-raised, educated, and traveled, and is appreciative of all these privileges by bringing this disposition to the position of DJing. Let's just say this about DJ Cool Marv. You cannot not get down with a man who has such a cultural, anthropological knowledge of music. Come on up, DJ Cool Marv. And I left DJ Lene Denise to last for a reason. I just wanted to take a moment to really applaud and appreciate the vision that you created in bringing all of this together. We've had several conversations in doing this. Putting events together is hard, it's tough, it's challenging, it's energy, it's spirit, and you brought all of those to the table. And I just want to take a minute for all of us to say thank you to you and to acknowledge you and bless you for that. And DJ Lene Denise uses turntables and conscious event planning to create forums exploring and celebrating Afro-diasporic music. Her work is informed, inspired, and elevated by black social and political movements, global travel, and personal identity. After the Dance grew from a desire to honor the brilliant and complex career and life of Michael Jackson outside of the club walls, then they produced pioneering events such as Atlantis, where sci-fi meets house meets dance, and Brixton in Brooklyn, the UK sound in Brooklyn's underground. Lene is the founder of Wild Seed Music, whose mission, entertainment with a thesis, is driven by a desire to incorporate the non-traditional elements of literature, cultural criticism, and ethnomusicology into the New York music scene. She works as the Director of Curriculum and Content for Exalt Youth, a nonprofit organization dedicated to transforming the lives of New York City youth along the spectrum of the criminal justice system. And she holds a BA in Sociology and Music History and an MA in Ethnic Studies. It always takes 2 years to read a black bio. What's that about? Come on up. Okay, so to be white, gifted, and black, managing acceptable representations of blackness as the king of pop. I started off by talking about the range of writers who had written about Michael in all these different ways, and the different documentaries, whether they were from folks like you and I, or from those in the artistic, literary, academic worlds. And from a range of a whole list of things that they wrote, things and words and phrases like radical innocence, racial suicide, a fragile vessel who repped the ancestral, the musical, the divine, somebody who was identified as part of the substance of the American dream. So many different ways exist to describe and discuss him. One of the things that was interesting to me, going straight to the big question of complexion, race, and how his face went through this transformation. Dream Hampton said what Michael Jackson did was to commit racial suicide. Others said that his face represented a piece of art, an extension of the musical genius. That's what his body became. The thing that is interesting that I want to ask all the panel to comment on is that at the height of his success, if you define success in music by the number of records that are sold, when you look back over his entire life, Thriller, he was still identifiably a brother. Certainly off the wall, he still looked like No Mystery Race, a brown-skinned, big afroed brother. And he was still beloved world over. We often think of pop and music as needing to be light and bright in order to achieve that kind of success. So I wanted each of you to just comment on the complexion challenges around Michael Jackson and what you think they represent, whether that's artistic, musical, cultural, and what they say about Michael Jackson. Let me start with you, Lene.
That is one of the biggest questions. One thing that I've been thinking about in terms of Michael Jackson and color and the evolution and shifting of his complexion and face is that I know that as a young person, I looked in a mirror and had fantasies about being lighter and or a different texture of hair. And the one thing that I had to, answer that call or respond to that was the money to buy a perm. So I wonder what many of us would do if we had the money to alter our bodies based on, some of the images that we learn about ourselves through in popular culture. And so I know that I just want to have us think about what it means to have access to an opportunity to change your body, to change your color, to change the texture of your hair. And that's what comes up for me. He had access to change, and he was on the world stage.
AJ?
Golly, I don't... Well, there's so much. I actually don't quite know know where to start.
You think there's validity in that quote that Michael Jackson committed racial suicide, or was it more of an expression of art, what he did physically with his body?
Well, I don't necessarily think those two things are necessarily mutually exclusive. I'm not sure I agree with the comment per se that he committed racial suicide. I think, there are a number of things that I would say it maybe could just be taken as truisms about Michael Jackson, one of which would be, I refuse to a certain degree, is this idea that Michael Jackson wasn't black or he was trying not to be black, when we know that trying not to be black is about as black a thing as you could do in the context. I mean, I'm just saying in the context of America.
Ain't that the truth?
I mean, I think that's a truism we all would have to acknowledge. I mean, just to reiterate some of what Lene was saying, I think that, you know, when we see my guy, you know, I've said that I think Michael Jackson was, I'm going to be casual or informal, you know, that Michael, I've said in the past that I think Michael Jackson was a nigga from the future, right? And what I basically mean by that is that, in a way, so many of Michael Jackson's moves were like classically black, meaning black American, in a sense, moves. They look a little different because, as Lene was saying, it's like what we have with Michael Jackson is a sort of unprecedented degree of power and access to various types of technologies, which increasingly are going to become normalized or normative. So really, there's nothing fundamentally different from Michael Jackson's cosmetic surgery and the, you know, obvious tradition of people conking their hair. It's the same exact thing. It's just that whereas people in the past had to be satisfied with conking their hair, altering their hair chemically, Michael Jackson was able to alter his actual features of his face. But that in itself, as I said, is a very sort of classical move. I mean, it's both familiar and alien. It's alien because it's new technology. It's familiar because we understand the impulse of it. Yeah. But I think it's like, to me, at the core of a lot of this, why this matters to us is that, you know, I'm going to try to keep saying as I've said before, but there's a thing about the nature of black America, the black experience, let's say, and what I call a kind of chained existentiality or the sort of bonded nature of the black experience, meaning, just to take a metaphor, if we go to various types of, let's say, what I term primal sites, those places that sort of have formulated what we would call the Afro-American psyche. Let's take the slave ship, say, for example. We know on the slave ship, I mean, in the mythic understanding of the slave ship, that people are chained together, people from various parts of the continent, various communities are chained together. So in a way, we start off with this idea that all this sort of diversity is being collapsed into a unified, monolithic whole. And we know, say, for example, if the impulse to say, okay, I don't want to do this. I'm not agreeing with the sort of notion of the construction of myself as an object, as a enslaved person. So I'm going to say jump overboard and drown myself, you know, which is a choice that certain communities from the continent made. Like, just to take a slight divergence, we know, like, the Igbos, say, for example, if you study this stuff, you see that it was very quickly understood that Igbos were not good people to try to turn into slaves. Like, It has to do with a philosophical thing in their head. Like, they were, in a sense, like closer to the Native American community. Because you can ask yourself the obvious question, well, why would they bring Africans, why would they go through the trouble of transporting Africans from the continent to the Americas when they had an indigenous population that they could enslave and use for labor? The reason they didn't is, like, by and large, Native Americans couldn't be turned into slaves. You could kill them, but you couldn't turn them into slaves. I mean, the kind of stories I hear is that, you know, they would chain a Native American and say, you're going to do this work, and the person would just sit there and let you beat them to death, right? Mm-hmm. It's because inside of their conception, they could not be transformed into slaves. They could be enslaved, but not transformed into slaves. And so when we go to the continent, what we see is the divergent response to this whole question of being turned into a slave. And we know that the Igbos, say, for example, like the Native Americans, couldn't be turned into slaves, which is why Igbos would kill themselves at any opportunity, because their philosophical and spiritual conception of themselves said that this is just a vessel, right? So I just want to be free. I just want to fly back to Africa, right? This is not conjecture. It was known that if you got a batch of what they would call Calabar Negroes, meaning Igbos and stuff, you would try to sell them as quickly as possible because it became learned fairly quickly that they were not a good bet to buy. I mean, buying a slave was an expensive proposition, so it would be like buying a car that refused to drive you anywhere. You know, it would be like a waste of your money, basically. So they learned this very quickly. Now, so if we go back to this whole idea of these people on the ship and somebody said, okay, look, I'm out of here, right? I'm going to jump overboard, right? Okay, we know the problematic, and something that I think undergirds our understanding of how black America functions around these things is that if we all chain together here and one person decides they want to jump overboard, the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to pull everybody else overboard. So it creates a certain kind of tension in terms of our relationships with each other, because if that person jumps overboard, you have a couple of choices. You can say, okay, I want to go too, right? Or you can say, no, now we gotta not only stand here, we gotta hold that person up, right? So I think that is at base the reason why somebody like a Michael Jackson kind of really matters to the degree, because we know on some level what's happening with Michael Jackson is setting off or just establishing certain parameters in terms of what's going to be possible for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the singer in the black community is already a kind of a canary in the mine shaft anyway, we know. So if you take a person who arguably was the preeminent prince to be king to be a black vocalist, I mean, the person who took, you know, black vocalism to as high a pinnacle as anybody ever has, in a sense, and in the midst of the hip-hop era where people fundamentally stopped singing to a certain degree. Mm. I think, so what's going on with Michael Jackson tends to matter on a deep, like, psychic, spiritual, and phenomenological level. Mm. So I don't know, that's just a short, I know I went off on a tangent a little bit, but I mean, just to try to set some frame to see why all this stuff matters to us, you know.
DJ Kulnov, when you think about the conversation, part of the conversation was as Michael transformed himself and got lighter and lighter and lighter, it was a rejection of blackness and a rejection of us, and so the demonization began, and to some degree, folks argued that we abandoned him up until when he died, and there was another embrace of him, and there was definitely a musical resurrection, and people picked the moment in time that Michael became theirs again. Musically for you, how do you see that happened? How did you see that happen?
Okay, I don't think that he rejected black culture more so than embraced all the other cultures that he was privileged to experience by being an entertainer, a global entertainer. I think it's possible that the roots of some of the personal, physical changes, his decisions, may be rooted in his young life, maybe rooted simply with his parents saying that you look good or you don't. And that's a strong statement if you don't have the support from the people that you live with that are raising you. And if, I don't know if his father ever said that he was beautiful. I've read and had conversations about Michael not feeling good about his look, his face, his nose. So I think maybe it goes back to just that nurturing and that sense of, you know, you're a beautiful person, but you don't really feel beautiful. And I think a lot of people feel that way. I mean, I didn't think that I was a beautiful person until Michael Jordan became famous. I'm almost 41, so that was like 1984. So I was in high school. And as a young boy, I heard things like, you know, hey, you're cute to be dark-skinned, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really internalize that stuff too much. I was just thinking the other day that, you know, if I could be anybody else, any other race, what would I be? And I just came back to, I'm pretty content with being black. It's all good. I think that those seeds were probably planted in his youth from some interaction, some conversation that he felt bad about being a brown little boy, and he got into wanting to change that about himself. And once he had some success and got around the world and hung out in the music industry and Hollywood and all those places where image is important, some of those things got to him, and he moved on them.
What's interesting for me, back in 1987, Stanley Crouch was writing a response in the Village Voice to a piece that Greg Tate had written around... what Greg Tate described as Michael Jackson savaging his African physiognomy. And Stanley Crouch had written that part of what Greg had said was it ignored the substance of the American dream and the inevitabilities of a free society. And Crouch was talking about part of being able to imagine what it is to live in this United States of America is the opportunity to shift and change and mold your identity as long as you have the access, the power, and the means and the money to do it. And that the shifting of that was a manifestation of realizing the American dream. That's one of the ways that he wrote about. This is what's interesting to me. As somebody who was born in London and has moved around Africa, having seen him written about from Brooklyn in New York to Brixton in London to Soweto in South Africa, this innocence of him as a child, this was this little brown-skinned boy who was loved. And I wondered about how for us as a people to be to be specifically identified as a brown-skinned boy who was clearly of African descent, who's clearly African, and to be so loved and to be so embraced, represented for so many of us having been rejected and abandoned both individually and collectively, how that meant why would he then shift physically so much when the one thing that black folks sought globally was that kind of embrace, was that acceptance. And definitely for African Americans, being in reaction to white people's dehumanization of them has been part of the whole genius of how African Americans have survived. So then when we go all the way back, I was watching Who's Loving You, 1970, Michael Jackson performing live, and thinking, wow, I feel kind of perverted the way this little boy is reaching like deep into my soul. And I feel like, do you know what I mean? When you're watching him when he's really young, and you feel kind of like, is this right for me to have, to feel so fulfilled by a little boy reaching so deep into my soul? It's not sexual, but it's somewhere, I think spiritual is not even the right word. So when you go all the way back to him as a little boy, and you look at the visuals then and think about who he was musically then, talk about how that fits in with what he represented in terms of pop and what it meant for you.
But it's interesting because we have, again, different relationships with him based on the decade. I have a relationship with Michael Jackson based on watching him seem more comfortable as a 10-year-old than he was as a 25-year-old. And just, you know, before he had kind of moved through these different worlds and had been informed about where he should be, how he should look. But I want to just really talk about what happens in our homes, and this is why I wanted to discuss just what Michael Jackson brings up for us, dysfunction in our homes, and what it means to be told, you know, by your father that your nose is big, by your brothers that you're ugly. But also, he went through like 2 years of having serious acne on the world stage, and I remember having a pimple before the prom, and I struggled, you know, like, I don't want to be seen publicly with this one pimple. He had a face full of acne, you know, pimples for 2 years. And I just, and he said that that was a moment for him that changed the way he saw himself. He said that he felt ugly because of those things, because of what he heard in his home, because of what, who he saw being elevated in popular culture. And so, you know, I think that if, again, if you have the money to become the person, the people that are praised, then, I mean, I think there's a strong chance that many of us, if we're not from the Igbo tribe, because I think I am from the Igbo tribe because I went from perm to locks. I think maybe I had some Igbo, you know, blood in me. But no, but there's a real thing to see, to constantly watch people being elevated. And when you then have that title, the king of popular culture, the king of pop, the king of popular culture, and you think about what informs popular culture, I think we struggle. We know that popular culture is informed by European standards of beauty. So Michael Jackson being the king of that, I think, comes through in his desire to, you know, alter his body with the money that he had. But so, I think it brings up dysfunction in our families. I think it brings up the infinite and eternal battle to kind of be peers, to level the playing field, to be seen, to be visible. And, yeah, so I think that's where I am.
Let me just jump in. Well, first of all, I don't actually think most black Americans have little, if any, the Igbo strand in them. No, the classic black American position is survival at any cost. with all the ramifications and problematics and pluses and minuses of that. I mean, the Igbos are not apparent in our philosophical traditions because the Igbos didn't survive. Mm. They made different sets of choices. Nam June Paik, who's a father of video art, Korean actually, he has a really incredible quote, what he said, the culture that's going to survive in the future is a culture that you can carry around in your head. Mm. And I always thought, like, the Black American community is such a profound example of that, because if you look at where we're strong in precisely the areas where we could carry the culture on our nervous systems, meaning in the Middle Passage. If you look at our traditions, like, we're really strong oratorically, dance, music, right? And it's not to say that we don't have these profoundly rich and deep traditions on the continent around other types of expressivity, particularly material expressivity, sculpture, painting, all these other kinds of things. But those things are things that are, like, relatively speaking, underdeveloped in the context of Black America. And it's because, you know, you can't carry architecture on your back when you're on the slave ship. You can't carry material, those kinds of things. When we got here, we not only didn't have access to material, we were raw material. We were not human beings when we got here. We were objects, not subjects. So that undergirds everything else that kind of happens to us. Now, so, I mean, just to say, so I think, like, when you see, like, to me, like, I think a prime example of survival at any cost is, in fact, Michael Jackson's father. Joe Jackson, who Michael said was a genius. He said that Joe Jackson was a genius even late in his life, and I think Joe Jackson was a genius. The question is, what kind of genius, you know? Mm-hmm. We tend to overvalue the genius of musical expression, these kinds of stuff, and I think oftentimes we don't quite, it's harder to get a grip on, like, the ontological genius, genius of being, genius of life, genius of survival, this kind of stuff. So I think Joe Jackson made some really kind of profound strategic moves and decisions in relationship to his family to sort of transform the term and the range of possibilities for his family. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to Gary, Indiana, but it's definitely a no-end kind of proposition, you know? And so the whole idea that this guy who was working in a steel factory could take this family of, like, 10 or more kids and actually, you know, within a fairly short amount of time, in fact, take his family and have them be, you know, the Black American family, the dream Black American family living in Hollywood, it's just, I mean, it's unfathomable in the sense that nobody's like, to me, I think if there's a novel that's deeper than the story of Michael Jackson, it's the story of Michael Jackson's father, you know, and the choices and decisions that he made and all the sort of ramifications of those choices. I mean, I think classically speaking, in terms of Black American philosophical traditions, I don't think ontologically speaking that Black people have ever situated being in the body. I mean, as much as we know our bodies circumscribe our movement in this society, I don't think Black Americans think of our bodies as our being. I mean, we might obsess about these bodies because I think these bodies dictate how we can maneuver in this society. But, like, say, for example, Black Americans don't have a problem with the idea of a Black person who has a non-Black parent, say, for example. If a Black person has an Asian parent, we just see them as a Black person because we know it's not about the body. You know what I mean? So I think when you see somebody like Michael Jackson, the whole idea of focusing on this whole idea that Michael Jackson either wasn't Black or didn't think he was Black around the kinds of decisions that he made with respect to our body, I think there's a kind of asymmetry in terms of how we deal with each other on the individual level and the kinds of terms and criteria that we project onto him in terms of come to some conclusions about what his impulses were. Or what he was trying to achieve with the kind of moves that he made. I mean, it's really clear that, and I don't think mostly anybody would dispute it, that thinking that you're ugly and thinking that you're Black are not mutually exclusive things in this society. Mm-hmm. I mean, so he profoundly felt that he was not attractive, but he was always baffled when people said he didn't think he was Black. He was completely befuddled by the conclusion that people were drawing about the moves that he made. I think a more proper, or at least another area that we have to look at to dictate or determine how and what to what degree Michael Jackson thought of himself as a Black person was in the space that he made his most profound expression in, which is, like, musically and in terms of dance, where he was a classicist. In fact, I mean, all of Michael Jackson's moves musically and in terms of dance were classical Black American moves. I mean, you know, there's very little, you know, yeah, I was saying to Esther the other night, I was saying, even though, like, say, to save, like, say, on something like Thriller, when he did Beat It, he had Eddie Van Halen take the solos, the guitar solo. Now, personally, I was disturbed by that when I was younger because I was like, well, why didn't he get a black guitarist? You know, it's a sort of narrow nationalist read of it. But the thing about it is, it was a strategic move. It was a strategic move. And Michael Jackson was so far beyond. It's just like in the sort of genius of hip-hop is that it knows it's not about the body or the material of things. It's about how you move the materials around. Mm-hmm. That's what hip-hop is about. It's like taking anything and reconfiguring those things, what I call immaterial invention. Mm-hmm. It's like black Americans are geniuses at immaterial invention because we didn't control material. You know? Yeah. So, Timberlands, let's wear those things three sizes too large and untied. Let's put the pants on backwards. Mm. You know, we didn't invent basketball, but we created basketball. See what I mean? Mm. We have this capacity to transform things without changing the structure, the material, dimensions of those things. Mm-hmm. It's a deep kind of physics kind of thing that's happening. So with somebody like Michael Jackson, I mean, well, why wouldn't he take certain opportunities to transform how he was looking? Or why wouldn't he use Eddie Van Halen to take that solo on Thriller? Is the same exact strategic move as having the cosmetic surgery. You know what I mean? We all got self-loathing, you know? Yeah. But the thing is, what's deep is like what he did with his self-loathing. That's what's genius about this shit. Excuse me.
Kumo, do you think we really invest in Michael Jackson's sense of himself and we want him to represent this totally holistic, beautiful blackness that ignores all of our own internal trauma, demons, pain, and anxiety, so that when he transforms in the way that he does, somehow he no longer is able to be that to us, so we have such an emotional, visceral reaction to his change. Because I'm just saying, as somebody who came from London and other parts of the world, the way he was embraced because of the change, for me, was about a certain comfort in that type of blackness and black men. Mm-hmm. It was a softness. I used to say it was like a sweet swagger. It wasn't a hip-hop swagger. It wasn't a gangster swagger. It wasn't the swagger that's the visual representation on the media, where the black man is either hypersexualized or he's the threat. He's either going to steal your wallet or rape your wife. Mm-hmm. Those are the visuals that we know. Mm-hmm. And Michael Jackson was this gentle, soft soul in terms of the way he spoke, but he was badass in terms of his performance. So there was enough distance globally for them to say, now that's a black man I can embrace. Right. Yes. But as he changed, what did he become for African Americans? So do you think it's part of how much we invest individually in Michael Jackson, and that creates part of our conversation with him?
I can only answer on behalf of my own interpretation and how I saw the changes. I was perplexed, as it got lighter and his face changed. I was curious, but it didn't change the way that I heard the music. Hmm. I think many people on a very basic level, just a human level, just looking at a screen, looking at a magazine, were curious about what's this all about, what's going on. What was it, disease that he had? Or
vitiligo.
Yeah. Vitiligo.
I remember thinking, lots of people called it other things. What's that all about? There was this video where he had the shirt open and you saw the chest and everything. And okay, well, I guess that is the disease. I guess it's true. I guess it's not just makeup. But the cosmetic surgery and all those things, it just really perplexed me. I think that's the best word that I can give for how I saw it and how anybody that saw him from his young brown days up into his lighter days and thinner nose and cheekbones and everything else. When Arthur was speaking, I had a flashback, and I remember this Time magazine or Newsweek, one of these magazines had a cover story, and had this face, the complexion was, I guess, medium, light skin or say mulatto. And it was like, is this the face, the new face of the world? And the article has something to do with the darkening of peoples in the world in general. But this complexion was very medium, so beige, I guess. And I wonder if Michael, you know, just saw that just from his travels, his experiences, his insecurities about his own looks, and just tried to strive for this universal face, because I mean there are black people who are his complexion that are black, and then there are, you know, Latin people and Asian, and so it's a question that is not really resolved. Only he knows. But I was never really put off by the music. I do remember just kind of shaking my head sometimes, like, what's going on and what's happening with them, and doesn't really need to do this, and is he crazy? But then you hear the music, and it's like, okay, he's not crazy. So it's the best answer I can give you.
Is there a track that when you think about your musical knowledge, is there a particular track? I mean, for me, it's always 1979 on Off the Wall when I just think of a whole body of work, even more so than Thriller. That's just for me personally. But is there a particular piece of music that reps something special for you in terms of your own personal relationship with Michael? And if so, what is that? And what does it say for you?
You mean like an album or a song?
Album, that particular me? Track, yeah.
I grew up in Philadelphia, and I really enjoyed the work that the Jacksons did with on Philadelphia International, with Gamble and Huff and McFadden and Whitehead. Show you the way to go.
Do you remember that? Let me show
you. It's a song. It's something that I really miss in black music today, because it's like gentle guidance. Just come along. Let me show you the way to go. I don't know everything, but you know I do know, you know, some things. And that song, the orchestration of the Philly strings, his vocal, the lyrics spoke to me and encouraged me. Made me want to move. Made me want to close my eyes. Made me want to sing along. And that's something that was is really part of music in my youthful days. So that song really sort of is one of my favorites. And there's another song called Music's Taken Over. Mm. And another song called Good Times. Mm.
Good Times.
Think about the good times. And that song is very special. I remember, I don't really remember hearing that song with my family when I was a kid. But when he passed away, I had to DJ within like 3 days or something like that. And I remember, you know, every it was the first time I was going to play after he passed. So, of course, it was going to be some Michael. And it ended up being an entire night at this venue. I thought the manager would come up any minute and go, okay, that's enough. That's enough, Michael. It's been like 2 hours. Okay, please. But the hardest thing for me that night was to come up with the first song. And I think about the good times, and he's talking about family and together and being together, all those good things about just life, friendship, family. So, yeah, I really appreciated the Jacksons' work on Philadelphia International. And
family values, musical memories. I want to ask you all about Michael Jackson's obsession with childhood and trying to stay in that place. Something that you said, AJ, there was this really excellent documentary on BBC Two, that was a long culture series that was about how Michael Jackson's music had influenced black culture, and which AJ was featured on. And one of the things you talked about was the fantasy occupying a big part of how Michael Jackson saw himself, and wanting to stay in a particular place in time, and that was rooted in a particular tradition. And then, Linnea, you talked about the dysfunctionality of childhood and that how that impacted him. You know, AJ, what you said about what he did with his self-loathing was a certain genius, because in 5 decades, when you look at his musical catalogue, which I think probably the first time a lot of us did that, when he passed, you saw the sheer breadth and wealth of music that he had created, which was really extraordinary. But that obsession with childhood that really haunted him all the way through, when the allegations and the darker incidents happened, that became like a defining moment when a lot of us was like, okay, we want to kind of step back from MJ. My thing is that darkness is part of the musical genius we've seen in so many black male artists in particular. It's nothing unusual. But let's talk about it in the context of Michael, and what does that illustrate? What does that say? AJ, let me pick up with you. Actually, no, Lene, let me pick up with you.
And I'm going to answer that, but as a DJ, I have to answer the question about his
I
music.
Yeah, you want to answer that one too?
Yes. Yeah, we won't talk about our favorite
okay.
songs.
Okay, everybody say your favorite song.
Favorite
then
song.
I'm going to say mine too. We'll have the audience
okay.
say yours too.
So which one first? Yeah,
do your favorite okay. track and what it said to you.
It's actually almost violent, I think, to ask the DJ, not you, but what their favorite song is. It's like, what? It's just, please don't ask me that, what my favorite anything around music is, because, you know, just the catalog and the data in our head. But I will say that there are 5 very specific songs that stand out for me. Can You Feel It is one. Heartbreak Hotel.
You have to sing a line then if you're going to do each one.
Okay. Can you feel it? And this is hard. Oh, am I really? Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming with him and Jermaine, which is interesting.
That's what I remember.
Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming, right?
Yes. Yes.
Can't Help It, obviously, with. And Liberian Girl. And so I know what. Right. Whoa. Just fighting words. Yeah. So, no, but I do want to say, and just for all of those songs, it's very much so about how he enters the song, and it's almost like you get that feeling that, you know, that maybe some of us had with the Fugees when we were hearing Wyclef and Praz rhyme and we were waiting patiently for Lauren, you know, just like, when is Michael going to come in? And when he does, he's like, so Can You Feel It, you know, Heartbreak Hotel, Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming, Can't Help It, and Liberian Girl. And for Can't Help It, the fact that Stevie Wonder co-wrote it, the fact that it kind of represents his experience in Motown, mm-hmm. and then you have the Quincy Jones stamp on it, you know, I thought it was a masterpiece. And I also loved how it was sampled. Who sampled it, Robert? De La Soul sampled it? Can't Help It. And so it's just a serious song for me. Go ahead.
Let me, okay.
Which one did you diss, AJ?
Yeah.
Liberian Girl.
Yeah, oh, I think excuse me, as a West African girl, I just take that to
right,
heart.
That's actually deep.
Well, I think it's like, you know, one of the more generic songs he ever did. It was very much impacted by Billy Ocean and a bunch of shit that was happening in the 80s. But whatever, that's another conversation. First of all, I mean, I can't, like, you know, I agree with you on this. It's like, golly, what's my favorite Michael Jackson song? I mean, it's so many. But, I have specific relationships to different songs. Now, one song that I actually have listened to more than any, it's not true that I've listened to it, because I've had Thrillin' Off the Wall on, you know, constant rotation. But a song that I've listened to, like, critically, I guess, in a way, I've listened to it, is this late song by, not that late, but a fairly late song by Michael Jackson, Stranger in Moscow.
Love Stranger in Moscow.
It has a really incredible video where he's walking in slow motion. Gorgeous, beautiful song. And it's a song that he wrote apparently when he was in Russia, when his lawyers had told him that the first of the child abuse charges were about to hit. It was before they had hit internationally, but they said, okay, you're about to be indicted. This shit is about to hit. And he wrote that song, in a sense, in response, emotionally in response to how he was feeling about this tidal wave that was about to hit. And it's just such a beautiful song. And there's also a really incredible video on YouTube that has him talking about how he would make songs. And because, you know, I don't know if there's so much incredible stuff on YouTube, but there's this stuff on YouTube about Michael Jackson, how he would sing a song before he actually made the song, like rapping, like scatting. So he would do he did the whole thing with his mouth, you know, all the drum machines. So basically they would have to then take the drum machines and everything and try to synchronize those with the sounds that Michael Jackson was making. So I mean, just to, you know, I could go on more about Stranger in Moscow, but Stranger in Moscow is one that I love. It's really beautiful. And I mean, I'm not one thing just about his body of music. I'm one of those people who think that Michael Jackson went to a certain point at Off the Wall, and then from Off the Wall, it was a steady decline. Like artistically, in terms of the music, I think it was a steady decline. As he moved further and further away from the classical black musical values. Like one of the things that's super striking about that clip you showed with him with James Brown, is like when he jumps right into that thing, it's like Michael Jackson doesn't really do that in his career. You don't really see him going to that place. Reggie Hudlin said one of the most incredible things I've ever heard anybody say about Michael Jackson years ago. He was saying, this was might have been before Bad or just after Bad. He was saying what Michael Jackson should do is take a break, go get with some, you know, more Chitlin' Circuit musicians and make a record called In My Father's House that should be a return to the super hardcore blues values, which you really don't see a whole lot in Michael Jackson's work. I don't even think you see it in Thriller that much, but let's say after Off the Wall, I think it's not very apparent. Even though there are a lot of beautiful things, I think that's not apparent because I think that part of him was also kind of like it went the way that some of his features went. You know, it was like it was like the part, the indigestible part of the black experience that he felt like was going to sort of get in the way of that thing being able to go global in a certain kind of way. I mean, it's a valid choice strategically and artistically, but I think it's unfortunate.
So. It's an interesting thing. The one thing I've often heard is that as he changed physically more and more, that does absolutely chime in time with his the artistry dwindling on his work. That's been part of the conversation.
Well, at the core of it, and we had a little of this conversation too, is like what we're talking about is Michael Jackson's alienation from the community at large.
Yes.
You know, what Jeffrey did to Daniels, him artistically. In that documentary, Jeffrey Daniels, who was the guy who taught Michael Jackson how to do the moonwalk, he was Michael Jackson's dance partner for almost 30 years.
Shout
they danced every
Daniels.
Sunday, him and Michael Jackson. Most people don't know this. Michael Jackson learned the moonwalk because he saw Jeffrey Daniels do it on Soul Train.
Right. Yes.
Okay, now, so Michael Jackson was already alienated from the black community. He didn't have access to the black community. But one thing that Jeffrey Daniels said that was really deep, he said, we would always dance Sunday morning. And I would tell Michael, I would say, man, let's go to a club. Let's go to a club and go dance. Michael Jackson said, nope, can't do that. People react, all this kind of stuff. I'm not sure how much of that was Michael Jackson's own. He created that in his head. But I like to say, and this is a critique of Michael Jackson I'm making now, right? Because I feel a little bit like, you know, family members, like, you can't say nothing about my brother, but I can jump on this shit in a second, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm prepared to defend him against all these people who make these negative critiques against him. But also, you know, also I feel like I have a problem with, once he became isolated from the black community, the resources of his things dwindle year by year by year by year by year. I mean, in the end, at the end, he was going on fumes, I think, you know, which is why, you know, it's like, say, for example, can you imagine what, people think Michael Jackson's dancing is beyond critique. I don't think, I think Michael Jackson's an amazing dancer, but his dancing is not beyond critique. The more further he went down the line, the more and more he had these white choreographers doing this Arthur Murray, put your footprint here kind of shit. And you could see it. You can see it in the dancing.
No, that's true.
Michael Jackson had an aversion to improvisation. Nobody wants to admit that. Michael Jackson did not want to improvise. People say that all the time. He wanted to do the same thing every time. Some of that had to do with the training of Berry Gordy, all this kind of stuff. You know, greatest Motown was, Motown was in this weird kind of relationship between classical black values because they were trying to be the sound of young America, as Berry Gordy said. They were crossing over, right? Michael Jackson didn't like to improvise. People see the Beatty thing, 25th, and they say, oh, this great moment of improvisation. No, that was not a great moment of improvisation. That was a great moment of performance, but not improvisation. I'm going to say the last thing, and I'm sorry about this. But Michael Jackson, Jeffrey Daniels said this, and it's a genius pathology at the same time. He said he taught Michael Jackson how to do what they call the backslide, which became renamed the moonwalk. He taught it to Michael Jackson 3 years before Michael Jackson performed it on Motown. Michael Jackson's brothers had not seen him do that. Right. And Jeffrey Daniels said he was constantly asking Michael Jackson, when are you going to break out the black side? When are you going to break the black side? And Michael Jackson said, I'm working on it. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. It's getting better. I'm working on it. It's getting better. That is such a profound demonstration of that guy's discipline and strategic brilliance to hold that thing back. You know how hard that is? To hold something as amazing, most of us never create anything that amazing. But to come up with something that amazing and to be able to hold it for 3 years and never perform it in public to the exact, precise, proper moment where it's going to be like a bomb, that's some genius. That's some Napoleonic shit right there, right? But it also, there's an aspect of it that's pathological too. You know, because Michael Jackson, I think one of the reasons this thing diminished artistically as it went along is that at the end of the day, the dominant value in Michael Jackson's conception of what he wanted to do with music was to sell the most records. He admitted it time and time again. That's why bad is bad, not very good. Bad is a precipitous fall from Off the Wall and Thriller.
No, it is.
In terms of, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a precipitous fall from Off the Wall and Thriller.
It is.
It's not to say it doesn't have anything worth liking in it, but it's the beginning of the fall. And it's because he got away from, I think, all these other things. Even Quincy Jones was like, that's the end. I can't do this no more. You know what I mean? After that one. And then at that point, it becomes very, like, migrant worker. You know, he's, like, working with this person, working with that person, working with that person. Because, last thing, I keep saying last thing. Quincy Jones said something I think was really true. He said, look, a great album at the end of the day is never the product of a single person. A great single, maybe. A great, you know, single cut, maybe. But a great album is always the product of a brain trust. And you can really see that with Thriller and with Off the Wall. It's a brain trust. Quincy Jones, Rod Temperton, Michael Jackson, the Brothers Johnson, Greg Fillingham. Come on. That's the baddest assembly of black sessions musicians we've ever seen. So, as Michael Jackson, it's like Michael Jordan and LeBron is figuring out now. I don't care how great you are. You can be the greatest of all time. You cannot do this shit by yourself.
Kobe,
absolutely. You can't do this shit by yourself. I don't care how great you are. And Michael's, excuse me? Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, Pippen and all those other guys, too, Paxton, Kerr, all of them. Dennis Rodman.
So. I'm going to do one last, and then I'm going to open it up for Q&A. I just wanted to fast forward all the way through to This Is It. Because it was like, This Is It was a chance for us all to literally be witness to Michael's musical genius. Like, how many of us had really seen the process of how he worked and the genius of what he did, like, in practice? Last night, Touré told a story about Michael Jackson in the studio with Teddy Riley. And Adrian, you talked about Michael Jackson having an aversion to improv. But during the process of making that album and working with Teddy Riley, this is the story that Touré told last night, Teddy was watching him doing things with his body. And he's saying, like, what are you doing? And Michael was trying to explain that he essentially dances to the music as it's being verbally created. So it's as if his body is creating moves that then become verbally articulated. And so I just raise that to say, to some extent, does the improvisation, does being averse to improvisation really stand if that is part of the process of him making an album? When we think about This Is It, I know I cried when I saw that. I don't know about all of y'all, but I know I cried when I saw that. And to see that at 50, I learned again that Michael Jackson, as frail as he was and as sick as he must have been, there was a swagger that was resurrected for me that felt pure, that I felt that felt lost, and I thought, wow, this is just beyond language. This is the nigger of the future, as AJ said, all over again. And he was musically resurrected, not in this kind of pitiful way, but in a vibrant, dynamic way. So the last point I want all of you to comment on is, what did This Is It rep for you when you saw Michael, and how does it frame how you think of him having witnessed that documentary? Then we're going to go to Q&A.
Okay, just a quick rewind to the other question about the sort of lifelong child that he was.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that question.
Which connects to This Is It, because you could see that also in that film. I think he was fortunate enough to start as a little boy. And when you're in that world and all you do is create and dance and come up with lyrics and music, you're able to hold on to that childlike imagination because you don't really have to grow into this sort of mature adult that say that we are. We have to, you know, go to work, get up, go to work, and maybe take care of a child, go to school, study, things like that. And it's just, he can be in that zone of creativity, of performance, of rehearsal. It's pretty endless. I can speak on that because I'm a big child, and I just know how to pretend to be an adult, basically. I mean, I'm reading a book right now. It's, you know, it's not that heavy and not that deep, but it's called The Everyday Work of Art. And the author of this book speaks about imagination as an adult being basically, there's a direct link to almost thinking like a child. Because when you're a child, you don't really have boundaries. You haven't really lived through people's rules and perceptions and things like that. So you're able to imagine. You're able to look in, off into the distance and for as long as you want. And he had that kind of life where he was able to do that. And when you see this film, This Is It, I enjoyed watching him sort of thinking while on his feet and thinking about the moves that, or his, you know, he did this a lot, and when music's on, and it was just like he didn't control it. He just completely submitted to that. I'd never seen that. That was the thing that struck me, was how his body interpreted, as you would say, you know, both ways, how he interpreted what he was hearing, or how what he was hearing within, you know, came out, and then he tried to explain it. So, yeah, that's what I'd say.
Linnea Denise DJ.
Because there's so much that Arthur John. Okay, because I think it's hard to really sit with Michael Jackson having an aversion to improvisation when he was absolutely shaped by black music and a culture that is rooted in improvisation. I know that possibly as a Virgo, he was a perfectionist and didn't want to publicly make mistakes, and that the choreography was absolutely necessary. But when I think about the spins and when he decided to do them for, you know, 5 decades, I'm not sure if that, you know, just the improvisation within the choreography, I think is important to think about. And also just the guttural, visceral that we talked about last night, the hee-hees are very much so about improvisation. So I think that's a hard thing to separate from Michael Jackson. In terms of his desire to kind of remain connected to the child in Neverland, the Peter Pan focus, the Walt Disney relationship that he had, I watched an interview with him, again, at the age of 10. It was Michael Jackson and who's the oldest? Marlon? Who's the oldest brother? Jackie. It was actually Michael and Jackie. And there was a white interviewer who said to Michael, "What are you going to do when your voice changes? What are you going to do when your voice changes?" And I remember him looking and being like, "Wait, what do you mean I'm going to continue to sing?" But I realized at that point, you know, I mean, I assumed rather that this was a young boy who people were hoping would not grow up, and that he was taught to some degree with these questions that he would lose value as he aged. And so I think that was, you know, part of, you know, his struggle. And also, yeah, what it meant to, I mean, I'm 35 years old. I've only been working for like maybe 15 years of my life. I cannot imagine what it meant to lose sleep, to lose contact with the world, basically from age 6 until 50. And so I think just, and the, you know, a desire to, because he also connected with other child actors and actresses, Brooke Shields, Elizabeth Taylor, had this relationship with Shirley Temple, where these were some of the only people he could connect with. He knew that these were people who were alienated and isolated and kind of found it impossible to exist on a real level. This Is It was a struggle for me. I know that he is a genius, but I also felt like, and especially when he's doing the bass line and he's talking to the drummers and he's communicating what he needs to hear, but I thought he was struggling with dancing, and I didn't want to see him do that in London for 50 shows. I thought that he seemed desperate, like this was something that he had to do to respond to some of the financial issues that he was struggling with. And I also felt and sensed his struggle with addiction. I felt like he wasn't fully present. And it was sort of sad for me within the brilliance. And I mean, I think that's what Michael Jackson, within the brilliance, I saw the magic, but also the issues that, you know, I think led to his death.
Thank you.
Well, just for a point of clarification about this improvisation thing, right? There's a difference between improvisation and using improvisatory components as a compositional gesture or component. Yeah, compositionally, it's not like if Beethoven is composing a piece of work that he thinks it all up and then he writes it down. He's figuring out things as he's doing. So a lot of times, I think when we see these fabulous things that Michael Jackson is doing, we say that's improvised, but I don't think it is improvised. And, you know, the whole Teddy Riley thing, which I think is really great, I don't think that's improvisation. I think that was part of his compositional strategy. And I think it's a legitimate compositional strategy. I don't actually think you have to improvise to be great. I just think improvisation is a very central component of the Black American way of expressing myself. It's the capacity and the ability to go off script. And that was something, for various reasons, that he was a Virgo, that he didn't want to fail in front of people, whatever reason you want to do it, that he didn't really want to mess up in front of people. But I think the whole strategy of improvisation was sort of forced on us. It's like being able to function in free fall. So I would just say that. Now, as far as This Is It is concerned, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, my son, actually, I waited to go out to San Francisco so I could go and see it with my five-year-old. He really wanted to go see it, and I took him to see it, and he stood on his feet and danced through just about 85% of it. He didn't sit. He just stand the whole time because, you know, he's learned the moves. He's learned all the moves and stuff. It's kind of, and I don't think he's the only person his age. I've noticed a lot of young kids, when this whole big wave hit after Michael Jackson died again, they discovered Michael Jackson, and just kids are just completely drawn to him. So I actually quite liked it on a lot of levels, but not like in terms of was it good or was it bad. It just was. I mean, there are things in it that I thought were really deep and profound. I mostly enjoyed just seeing how Michael was running the show. I mean, to me, that was the deepest part about it. I think, again, because it's the consequence of this construction, soft-spoken, whatever. You know, the whole thing is very much like it's shit that's just happening, as if Michael Jackson's not driving all of this stuff. Like, I had a friend of mine told me a really interesting thing. They shot this video down in Brazil with Michael Jackson. And he was saying, he was one of the producers on it. It was like it was Spike and Michael Jackson and three Brazilian public officials, because there was some concern. You know, it's that video that he did. Have you seen it in Brazil with the dramas?
They don't care about us.
Yeah, they don't care about us, right? This is actually Michael's Black Power period. A lot of people don't know that. Yeah. This is a period where Michael and Janet got together and said, we're just going to work with Black directors, and we're going to do Black-themed things. People, like, say, for example, Michael Jackson turned into a panther. That's not an accident. Michael
Black
Jackson
panther.
Egypt. Directed by Don Singleton, that's not an accident. Michael Jackson working with Spike Lee in Brazil, that's not an accident. See what I'm saying? Now, but that was this deep moment. My friend said, man, it was really, man, it blew my mind. He's like, so it's me. I'm not going to say who the friend is because I shouldn't be repeating this. But Spike, three brilliant Brazilian officials, and Michael Jackson, they all sitting there, because there was some concern about safety and control, and they were shooting up all this. And so this long, interminable meeting is going on, and Spike is talking to these people, and the producer friend is talking to them and everything, and Michael just quietly sitting there taking notes. So finally, after a couple of hours, almost the Brazilian officials leave, Spike leaves, and Michael just sitting there with my friend. He said, at a certain point, Michael looked up and said, damn, I thought those motherfuckers weren't going to never leave. Like, now, and he says, hold up, and he says this not in, damn, I don't think these motherfuckers are going to never leave. He says it like a Black man would say, damn, I thought the motherfuckers were going to never leave. Then he got up and walked out. And my friend was saying, he was sitting there like, so this is what I'm talking about, the shape-shifting thing. That voice, read Lisa Presley, his wife, on Michael Jackson. She says time and time again, that voice was a construction. It was a strategy. It was a mask. She said Michael sits around, drinks and curses, and talks in a normal voice. And she said she kept telling him, why are you doing this? Why you keep using this thing? Because this thing, this strategy, it's like the fortress that becomes a prison. You know what I mean? It's not working for you anymore. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. He couldn't let it go, though. You know? Because he created a lot of this tabloid stuff in his life. He created a lot of that himself. It was like a thing that grew big, so big he couldn't control it, you know? So I mean, I just tell that story because I think it's a really deep story. And then my friend just said, he said the thing that blew his mind was not only how deep Michael Jackson's voice was like it occurred to him at that moment, this is just a brother from Indiana. It's a dude from Gary, Indiana, who's got, he done convinced everybody he's the black E.T. or something, you know what I mean? You know, so it's kind of deep.
Dark genius of Michael Jackson. Okay, so let's, we got a mic down here if you want to ask a question, make a comment. The only thing that I would say is we would rather you didn't recite the Bible of Michael Jackson or the treaty or the dissertation. I am that chick that will cut you off if you go on too long. But feel free to, it's kind of a collabo convo, so we want you to.
My question in line, improvisation and also composition and imitation. It seemed like Michael Jackson became the anti-Jane Brown. Let me explain that. Jane Brown making music would take his band after a concert into the studio. Improvisation. When the song Papa Got a Brand New Bag, he took them into the studio in Charlotte, North Carolina immediately after a concert and changed the course of music forever. And he did that throughout his whole career. He'd take it, do a concert, and say, "Hus, get the band together, Bobby Bird," and they'd take him into the studio. Michael never did shit like that. Michael's shit is composition. This brother that talked about improvisation is the essence of blackness. Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, all of that scatting and all of that stuff, that's the essence of who we are. Never separating music and dance. Michael became so good at what he did as a composition and imitator that people that don't understand blackness think, oh, that's a new shit. Ain't no new shit. Michael never came into the improvisation because Michael tried to get away from James Brown. Look at him early on. He imitated James Brown at Motown, right? But he did not add new dances and things. James Brown used to go from city to city, and every time he leave, there would be a new dance. The Four Corners. He got so good, they did a dance just called the James Brown. So I'm saying, like, improvisation is key with advancement of African agency in the Western world. And Michael Jackson, being a compositionist and an imitator, don't do that. Everybody in the world try to imitate the so-called African American, but nobody duplicate them, not even Michael Jackson.
Powerful. Anybody want to respond to that?
I mean, I agree with everything you said, brother, except that Michael Jackson was an imitator and he was trying to get away from James Brown. Yeah. But everything else you said, I absolutely agree with. But I don't think he was trying to get away from James Brown. I mean, everybody imitates. There ain't nobody ever in the history
imitation
of mankind
of the
did anything where they weren't imitating somebody else. James Brown was, his career started when he got a bunch of gigs substituting for Little Richard. You know? I mean, his early look is.
Huh? James Brown in Greenfield, South Carolina, and jump on stage at halftime after Little Richard played. He jump on him and his band, and then nobody goes to see Little Richard after James Brown got on stage.
But I don't know how it's quite honestly humanly possible to be a creative person and not improvise in what you present as your art. I don't know how it's possible to be creative and not improvise.
But I mean, when we say improvisation, we don't mean, because we know in reality things never go exactly the way you planned them. But what we're talking about is an embrace of the idea of going off script. That's what we're talking about. Privileging the idea of going off script. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's always some disjunction between what you imagine things to be and what the real terms dictate they're going to be, and you try to accommodate those things. But the whole idea of saying, I'm going to go into this thing, and we're going to go off script from the beginning. That's what I mean by improvisation. I mean, improvisation existed in European classical music. You know, so it's not absolute times.
And there's a genius, even with an impersonation. Even within that, there's still a genius. Yes, sir.
Yes, I just want to say that Michael is my brother. I love him. And just because I love him doesn't mean that he's beyond critique. I just want to say something in regards to Sinbad, the comedian. He had a television show years ago. Ray J played one of his adopted sons. And in this show, there was Ray J and another little girl that was 4 years old, and Ray J was 12. And Sinbad made a decision that he was going to adopt those kids. And one of the jokes that Sinbad said, he said, you know what, I'm going to keep these two kids together because you saw what happened to Michael when they separated him from his brothers. So with that, I want to say that there was some talk at one time where his brothers had to make an appointment just to see him. And you alluded to the fact that even as great as Quincy Jones was, I want not that Michael kind of like got away from a lot of things. I would just like for you to talk about the fact that Michael had gotten so big, you know, just internationally and in his own mind, that he was able to kind of like circumvent common sense in a certain way. Because I know that my brothers, as much as, and we're a singing musical family as well, I know that there are certain things that if I was doing those things, my brothers would say, hey, this is not cool. Yeah. So I just want you to speak to the fact that Michael did have some enablers around him and how that kind of like helped to divorce him from reality.
Thank you. Who wants to speak to that?
I'll speak cool about off. It. I think just from the perspective of you know, his growth in this music industry, you had mentioned how after Off the Wall and Thriller, it just started to go down. I remember one of my feelings was, you know, black artists who start out singing with musicians, when they make that shift to working with beat machine producers, I almost never like it. It's always difficult for me to digest. And you wonder, like, why did that happen? And you use the word enabler. So these record labels, A&R, advisors, people, close people who know better, people who know how to work it to get the maximum appeal so that he can sell to the maximum amount of people, probably in his ear, okay, you need to work with this one now, you need to work with that one now so that you can... So the young people can relate, you know. So here we go with Teddy Riley and the Dangerous album, or working with just young beat machine producers, and that to me, you know, a singer that sings with musicians, that sings to a track, that sings to electronic music, essentially. I don't know. I feel like it's either or. You sing with musicians, or you sing, you know, or you start out with beat machines and you just go that way, and maybe you perform live with musicians. So I think a lot of those decisions were about how to promote, how to sell, how to keep them relevant. And I think he listened, and I think he went along. I think he held on. He had his opinion, and he had his way, and then he wrote the songs, and things ended up being his way. But I think he took all those things into consideration. So that there's, you know, people who become national and international phenoms are going to have people around them that always know what's best or what's better for them. And I think anybody, I mean, not just Michael, is going to listen. And when the hype or the bottom line is to be the best or sell the most, yeah, you're going to probably do some things that you might not have. Might not have done otherwise. So,
anybody else want to respond to that?
I mean, I want to respond to that, but I also want to respond to this. I just in the course of working on that documentary, I read so much about Michael Jackson. I think one of the most difficult things for us to imagine that's true about Michael Jackson is the whole idea that Michael Jackson didn't do shit he didn't want to do. I think that in itself is, there's so little precedent for that. I don't actually think, in fact, the whole idea that he made decisions based on what somebody else told Michael Jackson to do. Michael Jackson, people told Michael Jackson to stop having little kids come to sleepovers. And Michael Jackson was like, fuck y'all, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm Michael Jackson. Do you know who I am? How much money and power I have? I'm going to do exactly what I want to do. Quincy Jones couldn't tell Michael Jackson what to do. Nobody could tell Michael Jackson what to do. I mean, that's the monstrous and profound part of who he was. Like, And This Is It, my favorite single moment in This Is It is when they're showing the 3D thing that they were working on with all the dancers and all that kind of stuff. And Michael Jackson's sitting there with a lollipop in his mouth. Mm-hmm. And he's going like, I don't want that part. To me, because I was like, wow, this is like, there's so little few representations of a black person, black man in this instance, with that level of self-determinacy on display. Just completely doing what he wants to do. Nobody's telling him what to do. So I'm just saying, to that degree, I was kind of disagree with that part a little bit, like him working with Beat Machines. I think he got older. Mm. You know, as I said, his access to what was happening in the streets became more and more distanced. And so as a consequence, he just had to bring people, and he had to hire people. So Teddy Riley was hot. Then Roddy Jerkins was hot. You know what I'm saying? It was kind of very different from like where he comes out of that Motown machine with a whole bunch of stuff surrounding him, forming him, and he makes choices. But like nobody wanted Michael Jackson to work with Quincy Jones. The record company said no. Everybody said no because they were like, he's too jazzy. It was like, he's too jazzy. It's never going to be a hit. And he was like, no, this is who I want, right? One of the Mazzell brothers who wrote Jackson 5's first song told this really funny story about Michael Jackson. He said because these guys all went to Howard University, HU. they all went to Howard University, and one of their classmates was the head record guy under the head of under Yanikoff, right? And so in the beginning, they were going to take Beat It off the off Thriller, right? And he said Michael Jackson went there and said, you can't do this. And he was like, well, Michael's decision's kind of been made. And he said, man, Michael Jackson broke down and started crying, having a complete sob fest. And the guy said he was so unnerved by the whole thing that he said, okay, Michael, cool, whatever. We're going to just do it the way that you want to do it. And he said, Michael, just stop crying on the dance. And stood up and walked out.
Lene, you know? we want to get folks in. I'm going to get as many questions
because
as possible.
Just context, as I'm just thinking about some of our own families and how it's good to get away, first of all. No, because I know that you... No, but I know that someone mentioned just what happened in terms of the alienation of
family separation.
I just kind of want to talk about some of the context around that 80s and 90s period where, I mean, even, you know, just thinking about what was happening in the home, first of all, Michael and LaToya were the last to leave the home. I think Michael stayed at home at Havenhurst until, like, he was 30 years old. And so that's an That's an interesting thing to, you know, think about, and just how long he actually had been home and how much of his brothers' lives he had been a part of. All of his brothers had moved out and got married. Janet Jackson was in a relationship, married to and living in the home of Catherine and Joe Jackson with James DeBarge. LaToya Jackson later on was, you know, I don't know. I want to give it a little more crazy, like more context than crazy, because she, I mean, the impact that the Jehovah's Witnesses had on their psyche is something to be talked about maybe at a later time, and their responses to that oppressive kind of, matter of fact, I mean, stay away from talking about religion right now, but I do know that the Jehovah's Witness, you know, impact on Michael Jackson and LaToya is real. So just thinking about some of the things that were going on in his home, and then I think Nelson George talked about yesterday, following the burn that he experienced with the Pepsi-Cola incident, or the addiction actually was a response to that. He was on a number of painkillers, and one thing that his family did struggle with was, you know, intervention. So I think that was just the beginning of the decline, him alienating himself away from his family and just kind of trying to find his own voice, but also having that voice being muddled by the drugs that he was on, quite frankly, the painkillers and stuff. Just the context of the family, I think, is important to think about.
Just briefly.
Real quick.
Michael Jackson had to leave his brothers because they were limiting him. Right. They were limiting what he could do artistically.
Right.
It doesn't mean he couldn't have come back at some point and done a tour with them, but basically they kind of made it impossible because they were so dependent on him economically. It was a kind of unworkable situation, and he just ran for the light, basically, you know?
Could he have done what he did?
They were also profoundly jealous of him, and we have to acknowledge this. All this kind of stuff, and them saying he had a big nose, which is as responsible as anything with him, you know, becoming addicted to cosmetic surgery. It was a response to, like, you can see it. They were talented guys, and Michael Jackson, you know, God's not fair in this respect. It's His talent is up here.
Right.
Stratosphere. You can see the difference.
Right.
Like, there's moments where they'll be singing different parts with the Jacksons, and they sing their parts, and Michael takes the mic, and
right.
it's a whole other thing.
Right. Right.
It's not fair. It's not fair, but it's true. It's true.
Right.
So consequently, like, one of the ways, one of the things that happened was the tension in the family was that they did that to bring him down a notch. Say, well, your nose is the biggest nose, and you're ugly, and all this kind of stuff, and it had a profoundly negative impact on him.
But I just wanted, but interestingly enough, he did a similar thing to Janet, and talked about her weight a lot, and again, just critiquing that, like, just coming out of the culture of talking about each other's body, and we are watching Janet's plastic surgery, which is not really discussed, but Michael played a role in, you know, her damaging her self-esteem as well, calling her dunk, and, you know, she was known as that, and actually, yeah, referencing the size of her ass, which we know for black women, we've heard it. We've heard enough of it. But to hear it from your brother, who you learn so much from, we know that Janet
was... He said her ass was big?
Regularly. The nickname was Dunk that he gave her. And they talk about it together, actually.
Because she doesn't even have a big ass.
I think she worked to not have a big ass.
Michael Jackson, I mean, Janet Jackson is like, whatever, she don't even...
But the point is, isn't the point, though, that also reflects... What regularly happens in so many black families, the way in which siblings treat one another,
right.
the teasing, and Michael Jackson's genius, he paid the price because he lost his family in a big sense. That's part of it. But I want to try and get in as many folks as possible.
Sorry,
we're running out of time. What I'm going to do is take two folks at a time and just ask us to listen to two questions and then respond so that we can get everybody in. Okay.
Hi, my name is Musa. This is in regards to some of us in the black community saying that Michael Jackson distanced himself from the black community and black people. Mm-hmm. Percy Sutton, a businessman in Harlem, has said, with integration, performers left the Apollo. The audience was still there. The Apollo was still there. But the performers, with integration, they had went elsewhere. And since performers were doing this from the Chitlin' Circuit, some of them even criticized the Chitlin' Circuit. A writer named Del Webb blasted them for being ungrateful to the Chitlin' Circuit because that's where they got their skills from. That's what fed them. So isn't it unfair to criticize Michael Jackson to the extent that we have, saying that he distanced himself from black people, when a lot of the big stars from Motown and other record labels, they went elsewhere to white places in Atlantic City and Las Vegas and what have
you. Okay, thank you. We heard you. Let's take the sister up behind you.
Yes, my question or comment goes back to the discussion about Michael Jackson's embrace of his blackness or not, and how on the one hand, his music seems to be rooted in this African-derived or African rootness, but on the other hand, his physical look reflects more of a universal look or whatnot. But I'm curious to know what the panelists think about the children that he decided to adopt. How does that reflect how he viewed himself as a black man?
Okay, we heard you. Great. I'm going to take the next one, and then we'll answer three at a time.
Ooh.
Yeah,
three.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Kiara Beverly, and I just wanted to start off saying that I'm currently in Cycle 22 working with Asadullah Muhammad, and he's a program coordinator at Exalt Youth.
Exalt.
And I just wanted to ask Lene, being that she's a DJ and she's from Los Angeles and stuff like that, just wanted to ask her, like, what have you learned from Michael, like, from studying Michael and his dancing, and, like, how have he connect with you as a child and as a DJ through his music?
Mm.
Okay.
Thank
We're actually going to take the next two as well, because I'm not going to get everybody otherwise. Don't worry, I got notes, everybody.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about This Is It. I've heard her commentary on it last night, and I've heard it today. And I just wanted to remind us that it really was an unfinished work, and as such, can it be problematic to judge an unfinished work as if it were a full body of work. It's also something that Michael never had a chance to view himself mm-hmm. and never had a chance to put the bells and whistles on. Mm-hmm. In one of my incarnations, I've been a writer, a poet, and if I were to, God forbid, shut my eyes before I finish my work, would someone reflect upon my verse and ask about my cadence, my sense of alliterative style, or my timbre, and just say, wow, well, that wasn't the poems that we were used to. I realized that he hadn't been on stage for about 10 years before This Is It, but at the same time, I think you can judge a work with its limitations when you see it live, not when it's not complete. So,
thank you. Got that? Okay. And last one.
I hope I can say that I think that Michael Jackson, he feels like my brother, too. And when he died, I participated, I mean, I talked to hundreds of people literally online about him and read all kinds of accounts, went on YouTube like you were describing you did. And one of the things that almost made me feel schizophrenic, like I was going crazy, was how many different perspectives there were on this man. It seems like everybody on the planet knows who he is and usually has an opinion. And it covers a very wide range. And to me, although I know that part of this discussion has to do a lot with his black roots, I think one of the things that he was trying to do throughout his artistic career, I mean, he was under a microscope from a very young age. And I think that he wanted to be seen as human. And I think that's one of the appeals that he has for so many people across the world. It's like he didn't want to be bound by, first, his family. He didn't want to be bound by, you know, gender, age, race, ethnicity, religion. I mean, he became kind of every man, and he became someone that can be interpreted on so many different levels. I mean, each of you has said something a little different about him, but I've found so much truth in what you've said about him, even though they're quite different things. And isn't that the essence of artistic endeavor, to sort of knock away boundaries and make things open to interpretation and basically make your humanity a little bit less limited?
Mm. Thank you. Okay. So we have 5 minutes.
Let's speak quickly on the first question.
Okay, so the first one was from Musa. This is about distancing himself from the black community, integration. Performers leaving Apollo, even though the audience stayed, the Chitlin circuit being blasted and accused, and that the performers left but the audience stayed. You wanted to comment on that?
Yes.
So I ask you to keep it brief.
Well, I think that if you're an artist, if you are a performer, and laws change and you're able to perform somewhere else, and you get an offer to perform somewhere else. You're an artist, and it's in your blood. You're going to go somewhere else to showcase your talent. And I'm not so sure that it was a conscious decision. Okay, I'm getting away from these black folk now. If someone in Paris says, come over here and do a concert, I'm not sure that the consideration is going to enter the brain. If I go to Paris, that means I'm leaving black folk. I'm going to Paris. Because French people want to hear me do what I do. So I'm not sure if it's, it's a strong line in the sand to say leaving something. I think it's more like saying yes to an opportunity. And then if you are global and popular and people enjoy what you do, then you're going to get an opportunity to go to Brazil and then to Moscow and England and you're going to get a chance to go from the Apollo to Carnegie Hall. And who's going to say no to that?
Okay, anybody else want to comment on that point? Okay, so we have the embrace of blackness. Though the music may be rooted in an Africanness, the looks became universal. And can we talk about the children he adopted and what that says about him? Anybody want to comment on that?
I'll say, that one real quick. Okay. Two things. Yeah, to me, when he adopted the kids he adopted, I was like, okay, this is irrefutably a sign of self-loathing. That, to me, was one of the ones I find a little indefensible. But I would also go back to say something that I was saying earlier. It's like people's Michael Jackson look. Michael Jackson don't look like no white man. You ain't never seen no white man look like Michael Jackson. Let's be for real. Like, if you saw a picture of Michael Jackson and you didn't know who he was, you wouldn't think he was a white man. You would think he was a black person who had done something to themselves. That's different from... Now, maybe that's what he was going for, but let's get for real. You ain't never seen no white person look like Michael Jackson. That's... I mean, I think that's crazy. And on the last thing is this whole idea of being seen as human. Well, don't we all want to be seen as human? I think that's the kind of given. The reason, the way, and this is not an attack on anybody, but why Michael Jackson matters for me in a way that he doesn't necessarily matter for whoever the young lady was who was there, is because what I saw as a person who's just a few years younger than Michael Jackson, you know, grew up in Mississippi, civil rights moment, integration, all this kind of stuff, and you saw a person who was this profoundly talented, but also seemed to be successful. He was roughly your age. You saw a person mapping out what was possible. You know, the terms of his success, given his talent and the access that he had, seemed to be dictating the extreme limits of what black people were going to be capable of. Mm-hmm. Michael Jackson had a cartoon in 1970. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That was like no precedent for that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, that's why we focused on them, because we got to see what was going to be possible for all of us. And I don't think that was true for people from other communities.
Okay, do you want to comment on that?
I mean, just quickly in terms of younger people, I mean, what the three kids bring up for me is actually Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye and Pacola, and just the depth of the pain. I mean, to actually go to the measures of owning three white little bodies, to own them, you know. But also, I am concerned about what that communicates to black children and who don't have the tools to think critically about his history and the political, you know, context for why he may have purchased the kids, and not even purchased the kids. Did I say purchase the kids? Damn! Purchase the kids. And I kind of mean it. But, yeah, I just am concerned about my own nieces and nephew who love him and watched the funeral and said, but wait a minute, where's the mother? How did this come to be? You know, and where are our little bodies in the midst of Michael Jackson's world?
Okay, I have to say one last thing to that. See, and that goes back to the fundamental problem of we have to make a new relationship, given this bonded nature of our terms and existentiality, between our communities understanding ourselves and individual success. That's the problem.
Right. That's
I mean, Mike Tyson raped a Sunday school teacher, and the ministers were in the pits saying that he was getting dumped on. Let's get for real, you know? We know when people get successful in the society, which to a certain degree almost assumes that white people have stamped approval on them in order for them to be successful. So we have to, you know, NAACP gives an award to whoever black person gets nominated for an Academy Award, don't matter what they're doing. And half the time they're doing some ugly shit. Right. Let's be for real.
Right.
So we got to make a separation between, we got to make a separation between a black person's success in this society and whether that success is worthy of being immolated or, you know, applauded.
But I think my number one point is, how do we do that at age 7? How do we do that at age 6?
You have to do that for your own kids and don't leave it to I'm just saying, Michael Jackson's going to he has a right to adopt whoever the fuck he wants to adopt.
But we've been hearing that we have to do, okay.
We can't be saying Michael Jackson can't adopt white kids because it's going to affect our children. We got to have a different relationship.
Right, okay.
We got to protect our kids.
I definitely think it's important for us to be aware of the fact that there is going to be a time where our kids will not have us there and they will be left to their own kind of analytical skills to think about
what child doesn't look at television because I can't defend.
I mean, there's a whole lot of issues of single mothers who are working and have kids at home.
It's unfortunate if they have to use TV as the babysit their kids.
I mean,
that's
it's more than unfortunate, but I mean, it leads to the issues.
But I'm saying, so we need other mechanisms. It's not Michael. It's the same thing, like athletes as like role models. I mean, look, Mike Tyson became a role model because Jack Johnson knocked out a white man when symbolically it meant something. Joe Louis knocked out a Nazi, right? So all of a sudden, we get this logic, if you're the world champion of the world, you're worth being, and Ali was great. But just because you knock out other people don't make you worthy of immolation.
So
I'm going to get out of this.
I'm going to have to stop you there. So I'm going to ask, nobody responded to the question the lady raised about this is it, that it's an unfinished body of work, and is it fair to judge it as an unfinished body of work? She talked about how somebody might reflect her as somebody who was a poet and a writer, and how fair is it to judge a book that is still clearly unfinished?
10 seconds on it.
Okay.
I didn't ever judge it as a body of work. I think if he had lived half the stuff that's great about it, we would never seen the light of day. I just judge it as a great opportunity to see Michael Jackson working. But I don't have no feelings about it as a piece of art.
And I'm not even sure if I'm thinking about it in terms of art. I can say that it wasn't surprising to me, although that he died 2 days later of a drug overdose, and that's what I kind of wanted us to talk more about, Pfizer addiction to, you know, chemical, you know, just antidepressants, painkillers in our community. I mean, Michael Jackson died of a drug overdose, and it was a homicide, and that's kind of, we don't talk about it. And I know that a lot of people in our homes and our families are addicted to antidepressants and painkillers, and so, you know, I think that that was something that beyond his body of work and beyond it being a finished product, what I saw was someone who was addicted to drugs.
And the last 2 points was the lady at the end who talked about, yes, she hoped that she too could call Michael Jackson her brother, that he reflected different perspectives, the reality of the essence of artistic endeavor being about the breaking of boundaries and crossing borders, and that ultimately was it about Michael's humanity being less limited, and isn't everybody interested in that kind of artistic creativity? Anybody want to comment on that, and then I'm going to do closing thoughts.
I think AJ did.
Oh yeah, AJ did comment on it.
I respond.
Okay. Didn't answer Kiara's question, which was in 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. How you connected to Michael Jackson's dance as a child, as a DJ, sorry.
Much more connected to his dance as a L.A. resident. Grew up watching Pop Blockers, watching, you know, Poppers, watching Soul Train dancers, and watching Jeffrey Daniels, Shalamar, and these other people who had an impact on his movement. And so, yeah, growing up in L.A. and watching him being shaped by L.A. dance culture moved me, Kiara.
Okay, closing thoughts, one sentence, each of you. Michael Jackson, who was he to you? Why does it matter? And what is important about having this conversation?
Very quickly, I did a mix of this Michael Jackson after he passed away, and I thought about a title for it. It sums up everything. The title was Minding Michael. Everything in those two words, minding Michael. Mm-hmm. Don't mind, you don't mind in the end when you hear the music, basically.
Okay. 10 seconds each, AJ.
No, I'll just say that, not a comment, that opening clip, just so people know, go to YouTube and see it, because that actually wasn't all of that clip. It's actually, Prince comes out after that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very deep. That's a conference in itself, Michael Jackson and Prince.
It is.
Come on, let's be real.
Let's
just
drop that.
Okay.
Okay. Lena, that's what you wanted to say?
Yeah, I'm like, he left me hanging.
He named his kid Prince, not once, but twice. I know it was a family name, but it's inescapable that it's bound up with his competition with Prince as being the dominant voice of his generation.
Lene.
That's still,
Jesus, so crazy.
No, so just the fact that he brings up so much of us, I think that we have so much to learn from Michael Jackson, and that I haven't been able to shed a single tear, and I thought that there was something wrong with me. I just feel like he left us so much. I feel like he left us so much to learn from, to dance to think about, to teach with, and so I thought it was important to simply have this discussion. I do. In our, you know, on our personal time, want to think about the serious impact that addiction had on his life and in our lives, that dysfunction in our family has in our lives, that, you know, and we will get to this with the next panel, sexuality, gender, and the impact that, you know, hypermasculinity has and on the ability for men to express who they truly are without being demonized. And so I think that he just leaves a lot for us to think about and dance to.
To be white, gifted, and black, managing acceptable representations of blackness as the king of pop, DJ Lene, Denise, Arthur, Jaffa, DJ Cool Marv, Marvin Coleman. That's it. That's your panel. Thank you.
And Esther Armav, being a wonderful moderator.
Thank you.